Welcome to Cross-Border Tax Talks, where we discuss the latest trends in international taxation, from U.S. tax reform to the OECD's latest developments. I'm Doug McConey, PwC's U.S. International Tax Services Leader. You can follow me on Twitter at XBorderTax. On this week's episode of Cross-Border Tax Talks, I'm excited to have Rebecca Lee back on the podcast. Rebecca is an international tax partner based in PwC's Washington National Tax Services practice with an emphasis on financial transaction. Rebecca started her career at the National Office of the IRS of Chief Counsel. Rebecca, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks, Doug. Thanks for having me.
Well, first off, I want to congratulate you as you join Pat Brown as a third timer on the Cross-Border Tax Talks podcast. I was thinking whether we need jackets like Saturday Night Live for the three timers club, but give me some time to work on that. So before we dive into the latest interest limitation regulations, Rebecca, one of your many responsibilities is leading our team of non-partners for our international tax services practice in Washington, including onboarding new associates joining the practice. What is one piece of advice that you have for someone just starting their career in this work from home slash virtual environment? Because I know that's a big challenge and a question I get on my social media channel. So what advice do you have for those just starting?
I think the biggest thing is be aggressively curious. So when I was starting out, I wanted to be in every meeting. Whatever you were working on, I wanted to learn more about, and I would do extra reading at night or at weekends. And I did everything possible. I'd pick up any assignment because I wanted to learn more about what folks were working on. And so when we were all together physically, the way you could do that is popping into people's offices, asking to tag along to meetings, asking to sit in on a conference call so that you could hear what folks are working on. In a virtual environment, on one hand, it's a lot harder. I don't have people popping in to check in with me. And on the flip side, I'm getting kind of instant messages, and there's a lot of them. But the positive is, because we're all on, whether it's Zoom or Meets or Teams or whatever, we're all able to bring more people to meetings when we otherwise couldn't. And I'm always happy to have someone dial in to listen in or to take notes or to help out. And frankly, it's a way that you can stay really engaged. And I took a time with each of our new senior associates who onboarded during this really interesting time and talked about ways that they could just be in front of people by offering to be that extra set of ears. And they've done a great job at that. So I always bring a buddy, but making sure that sort of you're staying aggressively with folks to get those opportunities and that you're doing some background reading and trying to learn about the stuff that you're hopping on calls are.
I love it. And it's very consistent with the theme that I've been telling the associates and the seniors as they're starting. And I've boiled it down, Rebecca, to be proactive, right? It's just really even more important where we don't see, where I say we, where the partner groups, where we don't see the associates as much or at all, right? They're not popping into people's offices. We're not running into them in break rooms and that kind of thing, or just wander. I used to love wandering around the floor and talking to people. And so it's really important for those new folks to really be proactive, ask to be on the calls, ask to be on a project, just really be proactive and don't worry about annoying people. Just really be proactive. So I love that advice. All right. Well, we're not here, unfortunately, to talk about careers and leadership, although you know I enjoy that a lot and spend a lot of time on my YouTube channel focusing on that. But what we are here on the Cross-Border Tax Talks is to talk about some new final and proposed regulations that we got on July 28th, 2020, with respect to our 163J interest limitation rules. So before we get into the specifics, Rebecca, can you remind our listeners what is 163J and really how did the tax reform, the TCJA, the Tax Cuts and Job Act, how did that really change how interest limitation rules work for corporations?
Sure. And you can think of it really simply as a worldwide interest limitation in the sense of if you're a U.S. parented company or you're a company who pays U.S. taxes in some fashion, we'll touch on how the rules apply to foreign persons, your business interest expense is deductible to the extent of your business interest income and 30% of your adjusted taxable income, or now under the final regs, tentative taxable income. So this can be a real limiter for companies who borrow money to sustain their operations. And particularly now, during the last 6 months, it's been having a particularly challenging bite, because you can have both the scenario of companies accessing their lines of credit to make sure that they have the liquidity that they need to weather the current storm, and having drops in temporary income so that they've got less income of a base to, that they can deduct against, and they've got higher interest expense.
So this was a really big change as part of tax reform a couple of years ago, because historically our interest limitation rules generally only applied to related party interest. And this really put us, you know, following the general OECD guidelines, and really, I think, put us lockstep with Europe and the EU, for example, and many other other countries applying this to both related party interest and third party interest. And then we've gotten a myriad of regulations, now some final, still some proposed, that really help break down how taxpayers should apply these particular regulations. But one of the challenges, before we dive into some of the specific provisions, one of the challenges that I know I've already come to you and you've gotten a bunch of questions about is timing and effective dates, because we had the statute, and then it took some time to get the initial cut of the proposed regs, and now we've got the final regulations. And so there seems to be just pandemonium on what to apply, when to apply what rules. So can, as we start to unpack some of these rules, can we start with just the timing and effective dates on some of this stuff?
Sure. And these are some of the hardest questions that we get. So base case, the statute. Statute applies starting for your taxable years beginning on or after December 31st, 2017. So basically think of it, when tax reform provisions apply to you, the statute applies to you. I'm gonna start with the final regulations, because they're the only thing that is now final. The final regulations that were published back in July, they apply for, in general, taxable years beginning on or after 60 days after the regs are published in the Federal Register, which has not happened yet. And frankly, there'll be a fairly long delay before these all get processed by the Federal Register. There are some anti-abuse rules that we'll touch on that have an earlier effective date. They're effective for transactions entered into on or after the date on which the regs are published in the register. But you can think of those as becoming effective for the next taxable year. We now have two sets of proposed regulations. And I think most relevant for the folks who are listening, we have two sets of regulations about how these rules apply to CFCs. And foreign entities with U.S. operations. Both sets of regulations, the ones that were published in 2018 and 2020, each rely taxpayer or allow taxpayers to early rely before those regulations are published in final form. Because in general, regulations are not binding on taxpayers until they are published in final form. Each of these two sets of regs has pros and cons. And frankly, because the second set of proposed regulations was just issued, you've got folks who had to make decisions for their 2018 taxable year or 2019 taxable years that are either have been filed or are just about to be filed. And now I've got this new information that's influencing, do I go back and amend prior returns? Do I leave things as is? Do I change course and rely on different proposed regs going forward? And folks are making some really tough decisions because the rules are meaningfully different in a number of critical respects.
Yeah, and that is a common theme of the cross-border tax talks as we talk about the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act and the regulations that we're getting is modeling, modeling, modeling. And so you're absolutely right, Rebecca. It's because we have these different layer or these different layers of rules that also can apply, that could apply to 18 and 19 years. Yeah, it's really important for taxpayers to model the provisions and see what the results are. And I'm guessing that we're going to have quite a few. And this isn't just as a result of the 163J interest limitation rules. It's all these regulations that we're just going to have a ton of amended returns. And then also, mm-hmm. as we think about the CARES Act and carrybacks and some of the changes in the provisions related to the CARES Act, just a lot of amended returns. I suspect that we'll see for U.S. multinationals and foreign-based multinationals filing in the U.S. for 18 and 19. All right, so let's dive in then to some of the final regulations. And I thought we would start with the definition of interest, because one of the things that blew my mind with the proposed regulations was the breadth of the interest limitation rules. It was like anything related to the time value of money, you know, and then we talked to our transfer pricing colleagues and they're like, well, even on the sale of goods, there's an element related in our transfer pricing studies to the time value of money. So is cost of goods sold now a 163J payment? And we're like, well, that can't be right, but this is what it says. So how did Treasury respond to a number of those comments? And what is the new interest, the definition of interest under these final rules?
Yeah, this was a pretty big deal. And frankly, I think this is a good representation of where when we help folks with thoughtful and meaningful comments, the folks in government really try to listen. So now I'll admit, I think a lot of things are interest too. I'm a little biased there. But what the regs did in final form was they returned the definition to what is interest basically for U.S. federal income tax purposes. So there's a whole laundry list in the regs and it looks fairly complicated, but it boils down to things that are actually stated interest, things that are OID, things that are treated as OID under the OID rules, and then some cats and dogs. There's special rules for, say, factoring income, which we all know can be interest under, say, 864D. They also wrote some fairly detailed anti-abuse rules, which I'm sure we'll want to touch on. But at its core, the things they excluded explicitly from the proposed regulations were all things that aren't interest, but that have kind of a time value flavor to them. So for example, debt issuance costs, which our clients in response to a survey said is the single most impactful change in the definition of interest, and candidly, frankly, the least exciting, because debt issuance costs are treated as if they were interest. They're a 162 expense and they're amortized over the term of the debt like interest. So I can see why folks thought that they ought to be in because they have an amortization that feels like interest, but on the flip side, they're not interest. They're sort of a 263 little a capitalized cost. There were some changes as well to things like guaranteed payments for use of capital, which Doug, I'm sure you'll get a sub-K person on here at some point to walk through all the cool stuff there. But the changes were intended to sort of bring logic to the definition and make it more in line with the statute, which is we're picking up things that are interest from a U.S. tax standpoint. And we knew this was coming because the drafter signaled it in the preamble to the 267 Cap A hybrid regs. So it wasn't this part of the definition, not a complete surprise, but they certainly did surprise us with some of the things they added in.
So you also mentioned the anti-avoidance rule. Can you talk a little bit about that? And then are there any, you know, other specifics with respect to the definition of interest you think might be worth highlighting?
Sure. And this is where I will say legitimately, I was surprised. The anti-abuse rule that they provided is very broad. And it is unlike any anti-abuse rule that I've read, either in kind of the financial products area or more generally in other international or domestic provisions. And this because it was not in the proposed regulations, and it was specifically in response to comment letters that said, we understand that Treasury and the IRS will want to try to limit abuses of 163J. And we think the best way for you to do that is by having an anti-abuse rule rather than having a very broad, expansive definition of interest. And I keep saying this is like, be careful what you wish for, because the anti-abuse rule that they wrote has some unusual features. So it basically looks at, did you have a principal purpose of the avoidance of the purposes of 163J? Either because you're characterizing a cost as not interest when it should be treated as interest for purposes of 163J, or you're treating an item as interest income to create capacity for deductions where the item is not properly treated as interest from a U.S. federal income tax standpoint. They provided a definition of principal purpose, which is extremely broad. So first of all, it's a principal purpose, not the principal purpose. And we've had to navigate that before with other rules, that you can have other good valid purposes and still have a purpose that is principal that involves tax avoidance. But this rule goes beyond that. And they call out specifically that you can have valid reasons for engaging in the transaction and that those purposes can outweigh any potential 163J benefit and the transaction could still have a principal purpose. of avoiding the purposes of 163J. The thing that's helpful here, because when we stop here, people get really freaked out because they think they're going back to where you started, which is anything that has time value, anything that's forward priced, all has components that we would worry about under the anti-abuse rule. But they do carve it back. They say it's a facts and circumstances analysis, and then they provide in the regulation the type of laundry list of factors that they would consider, some of which I feel like as tax practitioners, we would have been considering anyway. Was the transaction transitory? Did it involve a circular flow of cash? Are the parties related? And what influence does that have on the transaction? Did the transaction occur in the ordinary course of the taxpayer's business? And other factors. And some of those factors they then pull through. They have five very detailed examples, each of which seems to pull something that had been in the scope of the original proposed regulations. They pull it out, they make it an example, and then they add in a rich amount of detail to make it look like almost a transaction that doesn't occur in nature. So for example, the first situation involving a taxpayer involves a taxpayer who had a borrowing in US dollar at a fixed rate of interest, who has no additional need for cash in their business, has no additional need for an additional borrowing, goes to the bank that it borrowed from and says, I would prefer it if I borrowed yen instead of dollars. And I want to enter into a swap with you, the same bank who lent me the money and who now is going to lend me yen instead of dollars. And I want to enter into a swap that fixes my cost of borrowing to exactly the cost that I had under my dollar loan. And this business has no relationship to the yen. The company has no dealings in Japan. They have no nexus to that currency at all, no need for the foreign currency, no expansion plans that would cover it. They are utterly disconnected, but for wanting to enter into these two transactions with the bank. And I always point to that example as really representing the hallmark of what it seems that the IRS and Treasury really wanted to capture in the anti-abuse rule. They're looking for situations where I can say that I had, maintaining an external borrowing is a good business purpose. I think it always is. But the way in which they went about the transaction, the fact that it was not in the ordinary course, the fact that it had no relationship to their underlying business operations, takes this from a scenario that we generally see in nature to one that is, I would say, highly unusual and would be the kind of fact pattern that we would probably spend some more time with if it came up in the course of advising a client.
Yeah, those examples, I'm with you, Rebecca, were fascinating. One of the other ones that I found, or some of the language in those examples that I found entertaining was that Treasury felt the need to clarify that actually just going out to the bank to borrow doesn't in and of itself create this halo effect for a principal purpose. So in other words, like, well, hey, the principal purpose of the transaction was to go and borrow money. Then you could just structure it any way you wanted, I guess was maybe the concern. And, it seems like a pretty naive reading of the rules, but I thought it was fairly fascinating that they felt the need to include that in the examples. So Rebecca, there were also a number of changes in the final regulations with respect to determining what was referred to as adjusted taxable income. Can you highlight some of those changes in the final regs?
Sure thing. So the big deal here is the DAD add back for cost of goods sold. And I think this frankly was a change. And again, another good representation of something that we thought was sort of the case under the statute, where IRS and Treasury made some changes under the 2018 proposed regulations. Taxpayers made thoughtful, well-reasoned comments. And I think we've landed in the right spot. So the level set, when you're looking at your ability to take a deduction and not have a 163J limit. Your adjusted taxable income, that's the base that we're measuring off of, for years prior to 2022, is intended to basically replicate EBITDA. So it's supposed to be your taxable income before, among other things, amortization and depreciation. And in businesses that are highly kind of physical asset heavy, a lot of times the cost of depreciation, amortization, or in the oil and gas case, depletion gets incorporated into cost of goods sold. And at that point, it's not a separate item, it is included in your cost of goods sold. And the 2018 proposed regulations said, you can add back depreciation, amortization, and depletion, but only to the extent that they're not baked into cost of goods sold. And this had a huge impact on companies deciding whether to early adopt the other favorable provisions and maybe some of the challenging ones in the 2018 proposed regs, or to wait and just rely on the statute. And so favorable change in the 2020 final regulations is actually two prongs. So first, Cooler has prevailed, and amortization, depreciation, and depletion that's incorporated into cost of goods sold is treated as an add back for determining adjusted taxable income, or as the final regs call it, tentative taxable income, because we have to have more acronyms. So this was a favorable change in general and probably brought us back to where we expected to be before 2022, which is, you know, bringing back the DA. The second piece of this that was super helpful, and I think even moved the ball further, is there's language in the preamble around the effective dates. And I think you're picking up the theme, like the effective dates are everything here. There's language in the preamble that says taxpayers can rely on that change even if they choose not to early adopt the final regulations. And this was huge because you have a lot of companies who didn't rely on the proposed regs because the rule was unfavorable, who might have mixed feelings about relying on the final regulations, and weren't quite sure what to do from an effective date standpoint. And the idea that, Treasury and the IRS were giving them some flexibility to rely on this change was really meaningful, because then they could focus on the other ways that the regs would affect their business, not just domestically, but with respect to their foreign subsidiaries as well.
Yeah, one of the other things that I thought was interesting, and this was highlighted, I guess, or foreshadowed in the Section 250 regulations, was that there is still no specific guidance on when to apply the 163J deduction vis-a-vis the Section 250 deduction. And they've given taxpayers the opportunity to do any reasonable method, which for those of us that design calculation engines and do the modeling creates some issues with circularity. And so optionality, I think, generally for taxpayers is good, and we certainly appreciate that. And I think that's just something else to highlight, is just making sure the taxpayers understand that there's flexibility with respect to the timing, or the ordering, I should say, of the Section 250 deduction and the 163J. There was also a change with respect to the Surly limitation and the carryover for groups going from non-cumulative to cumulative. Do you want to just maybe spend a minute or two on that one, Rebecca, because I know there's been some questions and some comments on that?
Yeah, and this ends up going into, if you've got companies who have a significant carry forward, and you're going to have entities who either become part of a group after sort of during the life of the group, there is this whole question about, originally it had been a non-cumulative calculation in terms of the carry forward. And that sort of got to some really odd results, especially if you step back and you say the purposes of the consolidated return rules and overall the application of consolidated return principles is to try to put folks in the same position that they would have been in, but for if they were divisions of a single corporation, but in certain circumstances, ring fence certain attributes so that they're not able to be shared with the rest of the group members. And the change to go to cumulative, I think, is more in line with the general application of consolidated return principles. Certainly, I think there'll be more comments on that, particularly, and I don't want to sort of teaser alert get into what the rules look like for CFCs, but I think as we try to take consolidated return principles and apply them outside of a traditional consolidated return context, I think there's now more scenarios where the application of those rules start to get to really erroneous results. I think we're going to continue to find places where the rules don't work exactly as we'd anticipate.
Yeah, and I've seen that in the deal context with U.S. groups combining and just trying to do the modeling as part of a deal scenario, and that obviously adds complexity. So yeah, let's transition to the CFC, how these rules apply to CFCs, group elections, et cetera. So one of the things that we saw, and this was like out in the public, that there were disagreements within Treasury about whether 163J should apply at the CFC level. And I feel like, I'm sure there's all kinds of agreements within Treasury regularly. There's all kinds of smart people with various opinions, but this was one that actually kind of leaked out in public. And after the initial proposed regs, there were several panels with I think at least a couple members of Treasury who were like, we don't even think this should apply at the CFC level, which I found very, very entertaining. I mean, that's as good as like tax nerd kind of gossip that we get in this industry. So I guess, unfortunately, that the 163, they did not the final regulations did not tell us that 163J does not apply at the CFC level. Instead, we got a whole second batch of proposed regulations. So unpack those for us, please, Rebecca.
Yeah, it makes for good theater, if nothing else. So, you know, I think, again, trying to be helpful here, trying to be responsive to taxpayer comments within reason. So the first thing, there are a set of final regulations, and we tend to breeze over those because we go straight to the various sets of proposed regs. The final regulations do two things. So they lay out and they say, Doug, exactly what you said. 163J applies at the CFC level because CFCs have to compute both their subpart F income and their GILTI using U.S. federal income tax principles under 952-2. And so they hang their hat on that and they say the limitation applies at the CFC level, and they really don't want to hear more about it. And second is they say under the final regulations, a U.S. shareholder of a CFC is not permitted to take into account the subpart F income, the GILTI inclusion, or the Section 78 gross up in determining its tentative taxable income, its adjusted taxable income. And so the confluence of those two things in final regulations put companies in a position that if you go with kind of do nothing, you end up in a spot where your CFCs can have deductions limited to the extent that you have material borrowing at the CFC level and material interest expense, and you don't get the benefit of the inclusions from the CFC's operations. And that's a not tenable place to be. So the other piece, now we turn to the proposed regulations. So in 2018, you had a group election. And the group election basically was a bottoms-up approach where you'd make the election for the group where you had sufficient common ownership, and you would start at the bottom of the structure, and you would do sort of the application of who's got interest expense and who's got interest income and who has overall taxable income, and you could share interest income and interest expense among the group members. And then once you had completed that sharing process, you start from the bottom up and you'd say, who's got excess taxable income? And it goes up the tier of ownership and then up to the ultimate U.S. shareholder. And this had some general challenges. For example, the group election was irrevocable. And in these changing times, folks were not necessarily comfortable making an irrevocable election based on proposed regulations. You had some practical problems. Like if I'm going from the bottom up of the structure, if I get three tiers up and I've got a deficit company, I lose all my ETI, which doesn't seem to be the intended result. I had to exclude entities with ECI, which made some sense, except that if I had like a finance branch or something that might have some peppercorn of ECI, it could kick out, say, my whole treasury center, which again seemed like not the answer that they were going for, because they were really trying to get to a spot of just saying, let's figure out what the limitation is, looking at your offshore group as a whole. And that's where the 2020 regulations were coming from. In proposed form, they say, instead of the old group election, which was very mechanical by ownership chains and had a number of very meaningful, very practical exclusions, the 2020 regs have fewer exclusions. So they got rid of the exclusion for companies with ECI. They got rid of the financial subgroup. And instead, they say, we're going to treat all of your CFCs that have sufficient common ownership, we're going to treat them almost as if they're a consolidated group. And we're going to apply consolidated principles to figure out what is the amount of excess taxable income that you have that flows up to the U.S. shareholders. And we're going to use that to figure out what are the attributes of the members of the group and how much interest expense is deductible. And this makes a lot of sense because this roughly aligns directionally with how we think about, say, the determination of tested income, tested loss, that those are sort of done taking into account the attributes of all the CFCs. I think it is still early days, but like I flagged, I think one of the things that's really challenging is the consolidated rules are frankly way harder than anything I do. And you can tape that part and play it for my M&A colleagues later. So they're really complicated. They're very dense. They have a lot of specific rules, and I'll call out the separate limitation rules as an example. Those rules will have a material impact in assessing what happens when folks make the group election. What happens when you have groups combining, Doug, the M&A context where you are acquisitive and then you're incorporating members into your group, especially if you don't do so on the date of acquisition. There are going to be all these places where taking our consolidated return principles, which are very complicated, and then applying them to a matrix of corporations, all of which have different attributes, is going to be really challenging. And I think one of the oversimplifications that I hear all the time, and I try to push folks on a little bit is sometimes folks will say, if I'm a multinational, I borrow all my money in the US externally and everything between my CFCs is just internal debt. So at the end of the day, this should all net out to zero and I'll get kind of my net taxable income, which is going to be close to my subpart F inclusion and guilty inclusion. And that's going to roughly be where, if I boil this all down, where I land. A lot of companies don't borrow all in the US. Like a lot of companies have securitization structures or factoring or straight up issuances through SPVs to the market that aren't through the US. And that's pretty common. Second, of course, don't forget our sandwich structures where I've got foreign owned companies who have US entities who have CFCs below them where borrowing decisions may be made in a number of locations. And more importantly, especially currently, there's a lot of jurisdictions where there are either currency controls or other controls where they have to access credit locally in order to continue to operate. There's just a lot of scenarios where even that base case principle doesn't end up being true in all cases. And then I have to bring together two very complicated sets of regulations in a really thoughtful way to figure out how do I get back to a spot where I'm able to deduct the interest expense that sort of economically makes sense when I think about whether I am over-levered or have excess interest expense. It's really challenging stuff. And frankly, there's so much of a quantitative aspect to it of really doing the modeling and seeing how the regs affect each set of fact patterns that you have that I've come to really heavily rely on our quantitative solutions folks, because this modeling is well beyond my Excel skills.
Yeah, it's a really challenging environment for sure with the complexity of the model. And then just anytime you've got options, you know, again, which taxpayers love, right? It just means you have to model those to figure out, you know, and in this particular example, which set of the proposed regs would you want to potentially apply? All right, maybe here in closing, I know there are a couple other aspects of the proposed regs, the foreign persons with ECI and partnership and some of those rules. We had Craig Gerson on with the partnership stuff. That's probably worth a separate podcast, as you highlighted earlier, given the complexities associated with sub K, and I love to geek out on that stuff. But maybe just a few highlights on the other two aspects of the proposed regs.
Sure. I think where they landed with foreign persons with ECI makes a ton of sense. You know, you sort of look at what is the effectively connected income using 882-5 principles and then come up with figuring out what the tentative taxable income and the interest limitation is with respect to those operations. And I think that lands in a really logical spot. And it also gives people an opportunity to learn the 882-5 rules, because I do think that is an unloved section of the regulations, and something that as more foreign companies have potential ECI, I think will get a lot more attention. The other thing that I would flag, and I'd say just more generally, we've given a really light touch to kind of the domestic aspects of actually doing the calculation and the ins and outs of that. And certainly those are things that my colleagues are spending a lot of time in the kind of core accounting method space looking at, because there were a number of tweaks on just the base calculation and just making sure that you've got all the entries correct. One of the biggest things when I step back and I say, what's like really keeping me busy on the regs and making sure that I'm thinking through all the things I need to be thinking about, there's a huge sort of operational component here of just looking at where the data is coming from. Like, not to bring it back to definition of interest, but I'll tell you, the number of things that get run through the interest line because they have an interest type component, whether it's forward points on foreign currency forward contracts or debt issuance costs or hedging costs or unpacking even what's in your own data, is itself a lift. And I think, frankly, a lot of times companies under the proposed regulations where there was a broad read, they just were taking a broad swag at it. So lots of little bits and pieces here to pay attention to, but I think particularly where they've landed on operations of foreign persons who have ECI, just I think it's a logical.
Well, a lot of great stuff there, Rebecca. So thank you very much. And thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of Cross-Border Tax Talks. A special thanks to Rebecca Lee, a partner in PwC's Washington National Tax Services Practice. I'm Doug Bocconi, PwC's International Tax Services Leader. Stay tuned in 2 weeks for another exciting edition of Cross-Border Tax Talks.